You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. My sincere pleasure to welcome you all today to today's event concerning policing in the United States in the era of COVID-19. Featuring experts from the Miller Center at Rutgers University, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the Security Program at the University of Ottawa, we'll be assessing the impacts of this disease on our really important law enforcement community, the broader state of law enforcement in the nation today. Indeed, at this very moment, major police agencies are reporting absentee rates as high as 20% to officers who are either themselves afflicted with the virus or in need of self-quarantine. And I'll tell you, as a commander who led troops in combat, 20% attrition of any organization is an enormous blow to the effectiveness and the morale of an organization. So our police are taking a lot of attrition. Reported crimes are generally down in America's cities as a result of many of the ongoing shutdown orders across the nation. Yet domestic violence and other crimes have in fact seen marked increases. But that said, it will likely be a long time before we understand the full scope of crime during the era of COVID-19. A matter affecting policing, as it will so much of the rest of America, will be financial issues. And these will emerge as well for our law enforcement community, if they haven't already, as states and cities struggle with budgetary implications of the significant contraction of tax revenues brought on by this crisis. At the same time, criminal organizations and extremist groups have been exploiting the situation for their own purposes, spreading disinformation in ways that could become very dangerous and very divisive for our population. Indeed, white nationalist groups and domestic terrorists, individuals who would seek to use this moment to further inflict harm on our communities of color or our faith-based communities, for their own purposes, these groups and their actions are on the rise. And finally, but perhaps most importantly, the mental health and longer-term resilience and endurance of our law enforcement officers is a very real concern that should be a matter for all of us, that they work so hard to support their communities while also trying to keep their colleagues and their families and themselves healthy in every sense of the word. It's a real challenge, and I hope you'll listen attentively to what our guests have to say today on this matter. Now, for the event itself, we are recording and streaming live. If you'd like to ask a question throughout our event, please send them to the email address events@brookings.edu. That's events.brookings@edu, or Twitter using the hashtag #PandemicPolicing. Pandemic policing. Now I'll pass the floor to my good friend, dear friend, General Lori Robinson, who will offer some additional introductory remarks.
First of all, General Allen, thank you. Thank you so much. It's so great to see you again. And having had the pleasure to serve with you alongside while you were in Afghanistan and I was in Qatar, and having had the privilege to watch you lead over there, it's nice to have the opportunity to be a part of this event. Sir, thank you so much. The other thing I would like to say, thank you to Mike O'Hanlon for everything that he's done, keeping, me straight and narrow. And we all know that's not an easy thing for anybody that knows me. I appreciate that. But most importantly, as a previous NORAD and NORTHCOM commander, specifically the NORTHCOM commander, understanding the role and responsibility that the military has to support our law enforcement agencies from the strategic level down to the tactical level, and everything that the law enforcement agencies do to implement everything that's necessary to take care of our families is just amazing. So I just really, from an introductory perspective, you know, I just really wanted to say how honored I am to have had the privilege to work with all of you to protect our homeland. You all are incredible people, and what you do day in and day out to protect the homeland is amazing. And I watch with grace every single day as I'm watching what's happening and going on. You, what you do for our communities and what you do for our families is nothing less than solid. And, you know, we're grateful for everything. So, you know, the interesting part for me is now I serve at home, but that doesn't mean I don't watch what you're doing. So I just wanted, before we get into this, to say thank you as a previous commander that was blessed to be a part of your life. And so I'm going to turn it now over to Michael.
Thank you, General Robinson. Thank you, General Allen. And thank you, everyone, now that we're about to hear from, who are all police experts on the general subject of American law enforcement and, of course, dealing with the COVID-19 crisis. My job at this point is to very briefly introduce three recently retired police officers, leaders, especially in the New York and New Jersey and Florida and other jurisdictions, who will then themselves introduce currently serving active police leaders in New Jersey and New York, as well as at the Department of Homeland Security. And we'll have a bit of a conversation about how we're doing with policing in this era of COVID-19 before taking any of your questions that you may wish to direct our way as well. So very briefly, we'll begin with Jack Donahue, who just retired. Chief Donahue was in the New York Police Department and the Chief of Strategic Initiatives, where he focused on intelligence as well as countering extremism and other important priorities for one of the most revered and successful law enforcement operations and agencies in the entire planet. And he will be followed then by Superintendent Rick Fuentes, who used to run the New Jersey Police and is also now at Rutgers University Miller Center, just as is Paul Goldenberg, who has done a great deal in his career dealing with the extremist threat and other kinds of challenges as a police officer, and also has conducted a number of major initiatives dealing with the threat of extremism and ISIS and other such movements around the world, where I believe he and John Allen got to know each other working with the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Council. Paul is also at the Miller Center at Rutgers, and we're pleased to be collaborating with them today. So without further ado, Jack, over to you.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's my pleasure to introduce a longtime colleague, Fausto Pichardo, who's a 22-year veteran of the New York City Police Department and is currently serving as the Chief Patrol. He's held a variety of patrol, investigative, and other assignments during his career. People may not know that the NYPD has 55,000 employees that keep New York City safe, and it's had a record of success that New York City can be proud of, driving murders down from a peak of more than 2,200 a year in 1990 to little less, around 300 over the last several years. And he's also working hard to maintain the trust of the public. Chief Pichardo is the Chief of Patrol, has the responsibility for nearly 20,000 police officers who patrol the 77 precincts in the five boroughs of New York City. He has some really great insights into the current crisis and has a ground truth perspective. Rick?
Okay, I guess we're introducing the speakers here, and then we'll just go from one to the other. So with his apologies, and I know Colonel Callahan was supposed to be on the seminar, but he's been called to a press conference with the governor concerning COVID updates, and that press conference is going on as I speak. In his place, after Chief of Patrol Pichardo talks, I'm going to ask Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Noble, who is Deputy Superintendent, manages the daily operations of the division. Not many people know that the Superintendent of New Jersey State Police is also the State Director of Emergency Management. When he has to don that hat, Deputy Superintendent generally steps in and handles the day-to-day operations of the organization, which with civilians and enlisted members is about 4,500 people. Colonel Noble is a 24-year veteran of the state police. He's a career homicide investigator, and he's a former commanding officer of the state's forensic laboratory system. He recently, for those who are IACP members, they may know Jeff is recently receiving the IACP Award for Innovation in Criminal Investigations for his crime gun intelligence initiatives to solve gun crime. He's the past president and current executive board member of the New Jersey Homicide Investigators Association. And Paul, I'll shift over to you to introduce the doctor, and then we can go back to the chief of patrol.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Rick. And I'd like to first introduce a friend, someone that has become a personal friend. That's Brian Darrow. Brian hails from the beautiful state of Wisconsin. When the department needed someone to really put their arms around how the department engages and interacts with the first responder community and the public safety community, Brian Darrow was that person that was selected. He not only comes from our world, the first responder world, the police world, but he also has a distinguished career in academia. He's done an exemplary job out there working in all 50 states. There isn't anywhere he hasn't been. He's been front and center since we've landed in this very peculiar place, and has been out there with police departments across the entire country. Brian has been working very closely with our folks on the border, on both borders, and is highly regarded by the folks that are responsible for protecting our infrastructure. Next, I'd like to also we'll be introducing a doctor known as Dr. E, Dr. Eastman. He is a unique individual, MD. He is the a senior medical officer for operations for the entire department, but he also comes from the policing world. He holds the rank of lieutenant at the Dallas Police Department, and is someone that really is uniquely qualified to not only understand the challenges that that police persons have across this country, but also has been in front and center since the beginning of the pandemic, and has a keen understanding of how that's impacting our men and women across the country. So, as a member of the United States Department of Homeland Security Advisory Council, I'm very proud to have the opportunity to introduce those two fine individuals. Thank you.
Wonderful, Paul. So now I would like to play the role of moderator and really just get one main question on the table for our four main panelists to each address as they see fit, and then we'll have a little bit of follow-up discussion before taking audience questions. And the main concern, of course, is how is it going in the police forces today with COVID-19? What are your concerns about how your own force is holding up, as well as the state of security within the United States in terms of crime and other such matters? And where do the rest of us need to keep our eye on the ball to potentially, in the broader policy debate, help you out based on problems that you see emerging or problems that could emerge? So just the question is going to be, what's on your mind? What's concerning you? What do we need to do about it? And I say this, just one more word of context, although I'm sure most people are well aware, most listeners and observers, we've seen, as John Allen mentioned in the introduction, attrition rates in some of the police forces of 15 to 20%. I think it's less now in New York City, but Chief Pichardo, I hope you can inform us about that. We've seen reports that some kinds of crime are down, but other kinds, like domestic violence and certain kinds of break-ins and car thefts, may be up. What kind of trends and concerns do you see there? And then more generally, again, as John Allen alluded to, we've got concerns about the ability of state and local governments to keep funding police forces at a time of such acute financial distress. So those are just some of the topics that could be on your mind. But Chief Pichardo, if I could start with you, what are you most worried about, and what do we have to do about that to help you out and to ensure good law enforcement and safety in places like New York today? Thank you again very much for being here.
Mike, and to all generals Allen and Robinson, to all the men and women of the military, both here and abroad, thank you for your service. To my colleague Jack Donahue and all those on the panel, and the men and women out in the street in law enforcement at this very minute, Thank you for everything that they do day in and day out. And it's my absolute pleasure to join you here this afternoon. And look, I mean, these are extraordinary times. We all know that, not just living and working in the epicenter of COVID-19, as we've seen time and time again in New York. We've lost 41 members with COVID-related illnesses that passed away, both uniformed and civilian. From a city of 8.6 million New Yorkers, the proverbial city that never sleeps has gone dormant. We're about 56 days into this. And policing this pandemic, certainly not easy. Everyone here knows that, both on this panel and watching throughout the country. And our most precious resources, what do I worry about every single day? Our people, our police officers, their health, of course, as we look in New York City, like we're rebounding and pushing back on this and doing extremely well. But we have still over 7 members who are in critical condition at various hospitals. And although we peaked out at about 7,000 members who were sick at one point, over 5,000 who tested positive for COVID and were ill, and over 90% of those have returned to work, there's still a substantial amount of fear that as this virus is pushing it back, that our members are going to still contract it, with the possibility, of course, our extended families, their loved ones at home, that they contract it. So from traditional crime, we're fighting, you know, shootings and murders and robberies, to now we're enforcing social distancing, the quote unquote new crime that we're fighting and we're facing in this city every single day. And of course, budgetary issues are reeking around the corner, specifically in this city, where we're well over projected $7 billion deficit in the city. This talks about cutting our next police class, which we so much need. As the city starts to open up in the next 2 to 4 weeks, we expect the crime surge to go up as well. The 56th day, we've gone pretty well, about 25% reduction in crimes, specifically our felonious assaults and our larcenies, probably due to the fact that a lot of folks are staying home, that people are not out at work, but our burglaries of our commercial establishments and residentials and our car thefts are through the roof, 25 and about 50% respectively. So there are a lot of concerns right now. At the top of my list, though, is first and foremost the well-being, the continued well-being of our members, so we can really get ready to police this city when we open up the doors.
Chief, thank you very much. And before I go to Colonel Noble with really the same question, just one very quick follow-up. Is there anything particular that you think you're going to need by way of help besides making sure the city has the financial resources to bring in that next class? It sounded like you don't see any way you can get by without that next incoming group, and you want to make sure that priority continues. Obviously, you want top flight medical care for your own people. Is there anything else that might be needed by way, for example, of the National Guard helping in any kind of additional way beyond what's already been witnessed? Anything else specific that you can put your finger on already where the policy community should be getting ready to help you out?
That's a great point. And listen, aside from being a well-resourced agency to our local, state, and federal partners, and we had the U.S. Comfort.
Sorry.
We had a tremendous amount of support from the state police, other municipalities within the city of New York. I think it's really on the policy side. I would say we're facing, as you heard, very well publicized the beginning of this year, various criminal justice reforms. We released in this city over 1,500 inmates from jails throughout the city, and of course more throughout the state. From the parole side, the parole stipulations and violations that some of the folks had that we needed to keep behind jail, those were lifted and without. So I think on the policy side, it's really the criminal justice reform push that we need to kind of level out. And there was an attempt made at it. I'm not quite sure that we're where we want to be to protect the 8.6 million New Yorkers and then some that travel throughout this city on a daily basis.
Thank you very much. And now shifting our gaze to the Garden State, if I could, Colonel Noble, really the same question to you. What's on your mind? How are people holding up? What are your concerns and what needs to be done?
Well, good afternoon. And first of all, thank you so much for having us and for allowing the New Jersey State Police to be part of this discussion. Just like the chief said, our number one concern, my number one concern, and certainly Colonel Callahan's, is just like the chief said, it's the safety and the mental well-being of all of our troopers and our officers that are serving. Time and time again, we've seen moments and times of just great calls to service by our men and women that are out there serving. As we all know, our folks have responded bravely. We've responded to this crisis without a lot of information. We all recognize that this pandemic was something that we never went to a class or a course on handling a COVID-19 crisis. Yet here we are, and the great men and women and law enforcement, not just here in New Jersey, but certainly all across the country, have just stepped up. And we see that day to day. We see our men and women bravely doing everything they can, and in many cases coming up with their own solutions. And one of the things that we recognize is that the regional response needs to be regionalized. Every region here in our state, we've got such broad density. We've got areas that are very dense, we have areas that are rural, and each region is certainly different. And one thing we've seen is that although we need to have a consistent message that comes from our leadership, from the state, from the federal levels down, but ultimately it comes down to the municipal police chiefs, the municipal commanders that are making decisions in the interest of their own towns. And so in that spirit, one of the things that we've really had to stay focused on is just centralizing that point of information so that because the biggest, one of the concerns we had is the messaging piece. A lot of different messages were sort of being relayed to our various folks throughout the state. So we really were concerned about that. So we, through leveraging our Fusion Center, which is our regional operations center, we centralized, we created a point of centralized communication. So all information is coming through that Fusion Center. And that for us has sort of helped, I think, our law enforcement officers on the front lines have a clear, consistent message. We recognize that in this time of great debate and concern, our people of our communities are certainly concerned or scared. And we also recognize that our officers, too, are trying to do their jobs to the best that they can. And making sure that they get a clear, consistent message through the various chains of command has just been critical. We worry about things like PPE for our officers. I think that's a very legitimate conversation that every police commander needs across the country is concerned about. We've created some mechanisms where we can analyze and track the level of PPE that we're burning through every day. And I can talk about that in a little more detail. And then lastly, our biggest concern is our most vulnerable citizens. We absolutely, having most of our citizens, other than the essential workforce, stay indoors, creates a safety net for those predators that are preying on our most vulnerable citizens, whether that be domestic violence, whether that be children that are living in some type of physical harm. So having to focus on the outreach to make sure that they have the mechanisms they need to contact us and that we have the ability to respond is certainly one of our greatest priorities currently. And that's probably the top three issues for me, Mike.
Michael, if I could interrupt, because I'm gonna have to run because I've got something else I need to do, but General Allen will really resonate with this. The other thing that I worry a lot about is all of our caregivers, whether it's the police, the nurses, the doctors, and PTSD. You know, we'll get through this part. The question will be, you know, when we've got that quiet time until the second wave comes, and I firmly believe there's going to be a second wave. We can dispute that all you want. But, you know, how do we take care of the people that are going out on the road with the policemen and women, out on the road with our firefighters, out on the road with our first responders, out on the road with the doctors and the nurses, and in with the PTSD. So, you know, as you guys are chatting with this, and I apologize, I have to run, but as you're chatting about this, it's something that I think is needs to be part of the national dialogue. And the military's had to deal with that. And it took us a long time to figure out part of it. And so the, what are the lessons learned that we as the military can impart onto our fellow brothers and sisters? So General Allen and Michael, I hand that off to you. I just think it's something important to think about.
Thank you, Lori. And
very good. Thank you.
Very good. If I could go to Secretary Darrow, I wanted to thank you for joining us as well. And really the same question to you, although I suppose from a more national perspective, of how do you see the overall trend lines with policing in the time of COVID? What's most concerning to you? What kinds of policy interventions that we haven't yet invoked might we need to consider? Over to you, Mr. Secretary.
Sounds good. Thank you. And first of all, I just want to commend our law enforcement community. I have the privilege, the honor of serving as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for DHS. And my responsibility includes outreach to the 18,000 police departments, the 3,000 sheriff's offices, and all the national associations. And every day we stand ready to help. And it's been pretty eye-opening to watch the resiliency of our first responders and everything that they've been doing to keep our communities intact. From my perspective, what we've been doing on a daily basis is trying to figure out how we provide guidance to our law enforcement community. Give you an example, a few weeks ago under Dr. Alexander Eastman's direction, who you're going to hear from in the near future, this gentleman, I consider DHS's MVP for all the incredible work that he has done. We released a COVID-19 exposure and risk mitigation best practices resource guide, basically a one-stop stop so you can law enforcement get the resources they need on mitigation of risk and exposure. Another example is we recently released the Department of Homeland Security COVID-19 Partner Threat Overview. This is a product that is basically looking at the different threat environments across the United States. And so from our perspective, we're looking at guidance. How do we provide from DHS, from the federal government, how do we give state and locals the guidance they need when they're in the trenches? And then the second part is resource allocation. And what resources do they need? That certainly comes through me, goes up the chain, possibly to the White House, and whether it's PPE equipment, grant resources, et cetera. So those are the really two things that we've been working on, guidance overall, and then how do we get them the resources that they need? I'll break there.
Thank you very kindly. And now, Dr. Eastman, if I could pose the question to you, and of course, you're focused largely on healthcare. But you see this, I'm sure, at the intersection of a number of other issues as well, healthcare as it relates to public safety and policing. So any comments about what's most on your mind and what you think we should be attentive to? Thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you very much to Brookings for the opportunity to be here this morning, to Deputy Assistant Secretary Doro, who falsely attributed the MVP of this crisis to me. Their office has done, he specifically, and the Office of Partner Engagement and the Office of State and Local Law Enforcement has done perhaps the hard work of getting the word out to our state and local law enforcement partners about just what resources are available. Like Brian said, I'm the Senior Medical Officer for Operations at DHS. I'm unique in the fact that I'm not only the department's only trauma surgeon on the staff, but I'm also the department's only dual credentialed law enforcement officer and doctor. So it puts me in the unique position. I lead our operational medicine program, hence the reason why I'm currently participating in this from sunny, beautiful rural Alaska today. We're up here, and my team is up here helping the state of Alaska with their response and in preparation for the upcoming commercial fishing salmon season. You're right in that my day-to-day job is at the nexus of, it's not just medicine, it's at the nexus of medicine and law enforcement and the homeland security of our country. And so from a law enforcement standpoint, I think the first, you know, sort of five critical messages, and one of them is really foundational, which is our state, local, federal law enforcement officers around the United States have done heroic work to this point. And I think probably the most important thing that they need to hear and understand from their leaders is that we will get through this, and we will get through it together. It's going to be difficult and challenging, but it's not unlike many other challenges that we have faced in the United States before. And so some reassurance that we have the knowledge and the ability to do this safely, I think, is very important. We have learned from everywhere that has seen large outbreaks and have been hotspots already. My team over the last 8 weeks has been in New York, New Jersey, New Orleans, Detroit, Chicago, Miami, Meatpacking, Kansas, the Navajo Nation, and now Alaska. So we've literally been riding the wave of this and helping public safety and the medical community along the way. From a law enforcement standpoint, I think, you know, there's four critical things that have to be done from this point forward. Number one, we've got to help our departments across the country understand exactly what an exposure is, what it isn't, and how you define that. And then that guidance is now pretty clear. It's out there. It's included in the guidance document that Deputy Assistant Secretary Doro told you about. That guidance is really critical because that helps you understand sort of what the threats are and what they are not. And I think of all the calls I get constantly, those are the ones that, you know, officers and departments have the most concern about. From a second sort of second part of that is, departments and agencies have to really hazards of doing this off of a phone. Departments and agencies have to adjust their strategy and tactics. For example, at the Dallas Police Department, which obviously I know the best because I, like every cop, everyone has to have a side hustle. So I've got that one that I'm still working. But at the Dallas Police Department, we've adjusted some of the call taking procedures to actually not dispatch officers on some low level crimes and run those through our telephone reporting unit. We've adjusted individual officer tactics about staying, maintaining a 6-foot gap and not entering people's homes unless it's absolutely necessary. Certainly not taking people out of situations that might put us at risk and changing the dynamic a little bit. So adjusting those actual tactics are important. I think from a law enforcement, writ large perspective, clear, concise, understandable return to work guidelines after both an exposure or an actual COVID illness are really important for our personnel. They need to know what's going to happen once they recover and how they're going to come back to work. And then the last thing I think is really important, and many people have alluded to this, but and I will give a particular commendation out to my time in New Jersey with Pat Callahan and the guys there at the New Jersey State Police. I mean, the true regional approach that the state of New Jersey has taken during this crisis is a model that quite frankly, we've encouraged other state and local jurisdictions to replicate because it really allows you to maximize the resources present in the region. And so, for example, if one part of your community is overwhelmed, police departments do this all the time. We'll very easily move resources from one place to another and adjust patrol levels and things like that. But if your healthcare systems aren't quite as used to doing that, and certainly large states aren't quite as used to sharing resources across regions. So a true regional approach. And then the last thing I would say is that probably the thing that keeps me up at night right now is we're actually getting through what is probably the easy part of this. And the really difficult part, certainly for American law enforcement, is the coming months where we're going to see unprecedented unemployment difficulties around the United States and policing challenges from a population that's tired and frustrated and in some places hungry. That we just simply have never seen before in our lifetimes. And so I would say that what's critical, again, just to come back to the beginning, is that we are in this together. We're going to have the best science and practice and PPE and all the things that are available for the nation's first responders. But we have to work together to really get through what I think will be the most difficult challenges our country's faced, certainly in my lifetime. Thanks a lot. I'm really glad to be here. Again, I'm sorry to be the only one, well, one of the only ones not in a tie and sitting here in the front seat of my car in Alaska. But again, glad to be here, and certainly we'll stick around to see if there's any questions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Doctor. Where did you say you are in Alaska, if I could ask?
Currently, I'm in a sort of the very outskirts of Anchorage, getting ready to get on an airplane and head to Southeast Alaska this morning.
Well, again, thank you for joining us. I've got a number of questions already coming in from the audience, but I think I wanted to, while I'm looking at those, give Paul, Rick, Jack, and John Allen the chance to pose any question that they would want to the panel, and then I'm going to go to those that we've received via email. So, Rick, Paul, Jack, John, any questions that are on your minds that you'd like to put forth? Why don't we take a round from any of you who want to speak and pose a question, and we'll put all those together and come back to the panel. Paul?
So, yeah, this is go ahead, Jack.
No, I was thinking along the lines of which we really bring the issues that the deputy superintendent and Chief Pichardo and the doctor had just mentioned, which is since we've suffered greatly and we're worried about our officers and troopers and agents, what do we see as a resourcing or a staffing model that's sustainable for something that's as enduring as a pandemic, right? So we've probably suffered some attrition, some sick outs, as we know. But that also has some complications with how we staff and for how many hours maybe people have to work. And I would just throw that out to our colleagues. How should people think about that, and how does that wear on the agencies?
And then, Paul, do you want to add a question now as well as Rick and John, and we'll come back to the panel.
And I think I'll segue off of that. We also have to think, and we heard the general, we heard Lori talk about a second wave. And in thinking in terms of the second wave and thinking in terms also of resources and budget, what are we thinking about 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months out as it relates to how we will handle this next wave, particularly from a law enforcement perspective, and again, particularly with diminished resources? So what are we thinking as far as the police leadership to address those coming issues?
And then Rick before John.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. I would ask Jeff to articulate a little bit more about the PPE formula that they use to be able to understand burn rates. And it has an application to what's going on now. It has an application to the second wave in preparing police departments on how to best prepare their inventory. And I think Dr. Eastman may have seen this when he was in New Jersey, and I think that's very helpful if Jeff gets an opportunity to articulate that.
And then finally, my friend John Allen, before we come back to the panel.
Thanks, Mike. And I want to thank every one of the law enforcement leaders and Dr. Eastman, who's also a law enforcement leader, for being with us today. Dr. Eastman addressed this briefly, but I'd be interested in comments on this. What has changed as a result of this crisis between the relationship of the police with our citizens changed? And Dr. Eastman talked about the real potential that unemployment, the slowness of the recovery of the economy, and a sense of desperation, increasing desperation, with large elements of the population that either feel disenfranchised now or are desperate because of the economic moment. How are we thinking now as law enforcement professionals and senior leaders who lead large formations of law enforcement professionals? How are we thinking now about how we will address the potential change in the conduct and the activities of our civilians as time goes on? Because this is a desperate moment none of us have seen before, as Dr. Eastman said. How do we adjust to that, and how do we take into account the desperation that we'll widely see in the civilian population? Thank you. And thank you for all you've done.
Absolutely. So let me start, Chief Pichardo, if I could, with you. I know that's a lot of questions. Don't feel the need to reply to each one, but why don't, you know, if each panelist could take one or two of the questions they most were moved by, and then we'll come to the audience. Chief Pichardo, over to you, please.
Sure, Mike. So great questions, by the way. And I'll start with Jack, and maybe I'll roll over to General Allen's point. And to Jack's point, I mean, it's widely reported we are a well-resourced police department, certainly 55,000 uniformed and civilian. And even at our peak, as I stated earlier, with over 7,000, our traditional shifts and tours are 8.5 hours. We work 5 on, 2 off of 8.5 hour shifts. And there was a point where we were considering, is it time for us to go to a traditional 12 hour shift in light of pandemics that we've done in the past, Hurricane Sandy, major blackouts, 9/11, of course. And then what we looked at was some of those resources that because of the pandemic, because of what's going on with COVID, from the administrative capacity, where things were generally getting shut down. We took those resources and we took them out from those administrative positions, and we threw an additional 500 police officers out in the street to backfill our patrol force. Because we figured if we went to those 12-hour shifts, we would now be probably contaminating even more of our members as those shifts now become larger, even though they're only here for 3 days. That would probably go to about 100-something police officers at any given 12-hour period in one facility as they're getting changed, as they're interacting with one another and so forth. So the ability to have those resources and be able to now take from our administrative capacity and those police officers to now flip them over and put them back out in the street to level off those officers that on patrol who were sick and were ill, COVID-related and related illnesses, to now put them back in a police car and answering those 911 calls was a tremendous advantage that we had. And to General Allen's point, I mean, look, the very foundation of everything that we do at the core of police work in law enforcement, no matter what part of the country or the world you are, it's human contact. It's engaging the public, both at community meetings or just waving good morning, shaking a hand, good afternoon, or responding to those 911 calls, some serious calls, some not serious calls, and of course, dealing with crime and arresting perpetrators. So in its totality, the magnitude of police work, it is always engaging the public. And now we have to take a step back and say, how do we now re-engage that public? Now it seems more and more we're doing some Zoom and Skype meetings, but how are we planning going forward? Well, we're really, really taking baby steps. We're starting out with our traditional phone conferrals and Zoom and web-based meetings to actually socially distant meeting of small groups of two or three key individuals when something's going on. I mean, we're in a position now, and it's been reported on a number of media outlets, of some of the things that we're seeing because we're engaging the public in a different way, in a way that police officers, I would say, dare I say, across the country, but certainly for the New York City Police Department, never dreamt of being police. You know, it was always about the traditional get a gun off the street, get a bad guy off the street, help the elderly lady across the street and the children. And now we're enforcing social distancing. So the realm of where we were and where we started to where we are now, it's a tremendous, tremendous difference in the lives of all police officers. And it's a tremendous ask. And I think they're doing very, very well with something that was thrown at them. It's very, very new to them. But it's certainly going to take a lot as we re-engage the public, as we continue to work on building that trust that we've built on for a number of years. As we go into perhaps the second phase, as the summer comes near, as the city starts to open again, it's certainly going to have some challenges. But I know the men and women in law enforcement, not only in this city, but across the country, are more than apt to do it.
Colonel Noble, excuse me, over to you, please.
So thank you very much. Just first, and to answer Colonel Fuentes' question about our PPE and how we are forecasting and how we're analyzing that burn rate. Early on, it was obviously here, just like everywhere else, we knew that we were short PPE, and trying to get the proper amount out to our officers was certainly critical. So early on, we tasked one of our analysts to come up with a tool to try to identify and measure the burn rate. And I do think that's a significant thing we can share to the other police commanders from across the country, that and really what it did was it looked at every available data set, such as staffing levels, population densities, resource requests that were coming in, Of course, CDC guidelines that we all know changed slightly as we went. But ultimately, we now have this metric that we rely upon. And after about 8 weeks of data now, I can share that in very general terms in New Jersey, our officers are, when I say officers, I'm referring to our frontline patrol troopers, patrol officers. This does also factor in municipal officers as well. We did reach out, and a lot of the data came from the city PDs and the town and even the rural PDs. And on average, we're burning through two N95 masks per officer every 3 days. Now, that's with the assumption that our officers are being told that to only use their N95 masks when they're going on a call where they have a higher likelihood of coming in contact with a COVID patient. And I realize that there's a lot of very difficult complexities in trying to identify what that means, but that's the general guidance. They've also been going through one surgical mask or cloth type mask per shift. So that has helped us to be able to procure, to make our budgeting requests, at least in the short term, at least over the next several months. We also realized that the burn rate for latex gloves for our officers was about one box every 2 weeks per officer. So we've taken this type of data, and it's been critical for us because we recognize that when we're making these orders, just like everybody else, it's taking months and months for these orders to be filled. So trying to come up with an accurate measure so that we can plan was certainly critical. And I hope that information, we're certainly willing to share that. And we also know that it changes every day as the data comes in. But to help other officers or any other entities try to plan, we've also done a similar algorithm for firemen, paramedics, EMTs, and hospital workers. Because like Colonel Fuentes said, as the statewide OEM coordinating agency, we are supplying, we're the main hub to supply all those entities with the PPE. So this algorithm has proven to be one of our most, I'll say successful, but I'm certainly not doing any victory laps by any stretch, but it's helped us manage the PPE currently, and more importantly, forecast it out. I also just want to touch on the other question about the resource, about the, how are we adjusting to changing times, and how are we preparing for it? Like Jack and like Colonel Allen were talking about. And for us, it is very important that the community looks at us not as the enemy, that we are in this with them, that we're in it together with them. And we know that, and we've already seen it. We've had, as I'm sure NYPD has, we've had multiple protests, and it's been very interesting dynamic for us. During the protests, we have our protesters who are, I've been out there myself, for the large part, very pro-police. It's unusual to be at a protest and have the average protester thanking us for law enforcement and saying, we support you. And at the same time, they're holding up signs like saying, hell no, we won't go. And it's a very interesting position that we find ourselves in. But certainly, like the chief said, we have to be focused on messaging it that we are not anybody's enemy in this, that we are community members. We're with the community. We're working with our community partners. Never before do we need to rely on those relationships that we've built over the years. We've all built such great relationships with our partners, community partners, religious partners, and we have been, and we will continue to let, this is the moment when we take that deposit out of the bank and we use it, and we now go back to them and say, we need to be together on this. And that's really where we're at, as far as whatever we can do to make sure that our plans, as we prepare for potential civil unrest or uptick in crime, whatever it might be, that we're prepared in every step of the way. And of course, just sort of a boots on the ground focus, we absolutely have contingency plans to reallocate our own resources. This is one of those times when we have to look internally at our own operations and say, what are gonna be the most critical components of our operation to support a peaceful, safe, town, city, or state. And where we can, we may have to prioritize and staff those functions which are going to become most critical. And by that, I mean looking at sort of some of our admin functions and maybe putting more officers out on the street, putting more officers out in these meetings with our other leaders, and focusing our efforts and where they're most needed. So it's all planning, but this is the period of time when we are we're working hard to get those plans in place so that we are prepared for anything.
Thank you very much, Colonel. Secretary Doro, and then over to Dr. Eastman.
Thank you. Three areas of concern for DHS. Certainly the attacking of our critical infrastructure, soft targets, crowded places. Can't forget our cybersecurity threats, and then the violent extremism. It was talked about earlier. So DHS, we're constantly evaluating those areas. But the most important to our state and local partners, we know that as we're seeing around the United States, cities, villages, towns, states are opening up. People are trying to get back to work. And what we've been asked to do is, even though the CDC issued back to work guidance for the critical infrastructure and first responder community recently that you can certainly take a look at on the website, we are trying to come up with different models for policing. A lot of our communities we know have departments that may have 15 officers or less. What is that going to look like in the future when, to a certain extent, traffic stops start again, more consensual encounters with the general public? And so we've been actively looking at different models that we hope to have different drafts for our law enforcement community in the near future.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Eastman, over to you.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm going to go take the maybe an even higher, a little bit of a higher approach and just say, look, you know, what we did a year ago will not resemble what we do a year from now. And our organizations writ large and policing in general, police organizations sometimes are slow to adapt. Now, we've been forced to change our ways for the pandemic, but the things and the choices that we have to make and the way that we change our operations for the future will define whether or not we're successful. I have no doubt that we'll be able to get there. I just think that we're going to have to work together. And I think, you know, my last point that I'll make, and then actually my staff is literally tugging at me to get moving and get on this airplane. So what I was going to tell you is look, if you don't have someone that can really give you high quality guidance and advice, you know, a physician, a medical officer, someone who can help you mix the scientific sort of guidance that's out there with the operational realities of law enforcement, then I would hope that you'd reach out to me, reach out to us, and let us either connect you with someone or, you know, if it's a phone call, I think most of the guys on this phone call will tell you I'll take it myself and be glad to help where I can. I will tell you, I've got the best job in the world right now because I get to be a doctor, I get to still be a cop, and I get to help a lot of my brothers and sisters out there on both fronts, both on the medical front and the law enforcement front. So let us help if you need it. And with that, I really apologize. I'm going to have to jump off for further questions. But again, stay safe out there. We'll get through this. And I hope if someone from I'm certainly not going to ask the generals to do it. If someone from Brookings can share my email with the rest of the group, I am more than happy to help in any way that I can. Thanks a lot. I got to run, you guys. Talk to you all soon.
Be safe.
You bet. Find out.
Stay safe. Well, I'm going to just pose one final question. And I realize that Chief Pichardo and Colonel Noble and Secretary Doro may have to run soon. We're up against our 2 o'clock deadline, but I may take a little bit of liberty with that deadline and ask one big question, because we've had a number come in from the audience about trends in crime and concerns about crime. Some of the questions are about whether you're seeing higher crime rates in different areas as there are displacement effects due to the virus and related implications. Some questions have to do with issues you've already touched on here today about domestic abuse and what kinds of trends you're seeing, what you expect in the future. Another set of questions has to do with drug rings and whether you're seeing the ability of distributors impeded. Are they having a harder time getting their product to people who work with them? Does that provide opportunities for law enforcement? That was one more additional question. There's also been a couple of people who've asked about gun ownership and the spike in gun sales that we know has resulted, as in many other crises of this type, if there ever has been something quite like this. But people are wondering if that spike in gun sales has led to any consequences that you've witnessed. So there's a whole basket of questions around trends in crime. And obviously, I'm not going to ask you to explore all those dimensions. So out of that set of concerns, is there anything that you would most want to hit on? And the very last question from the audience was about trends and how the police interact with the public, with potential informants, with potential criminals, and whether there might be a greater effort to keep distance and use sort of less close physical proximity and contact in future policing, if that's at all realistic. Very last point is that Chief Pichardo alluded to concerns about potentially releasing some of the wrong people from jail. Maybe there's leeway to let go some older or less threatening convicts, but wondering if you want to say anything more about trends that might concern you. So that big basket of questions, all over to you for your final thoughts of the day, with, again, the thanks from all of us, starting with the chief in New York.
So listen, I'll hit them real quick for the sake of time. And of course, I want to listen to everyone else's views on it. But as I stated earlier, crime has been down during the 8 weeks that we've been here in New York City, 56-day period. The call volume of 911 has decreased. One thing that we are extremely worried about is domestic violence, where we don't see, because these survivors are living with these perpetrators and obviously have nowhere to go right now. And the perpetrators themselves have nowhere to go. I think that we're seeing a lot of unreported domestic violence crimes. So I think once the city opens up again, I think we're going to see an uptick in that and of course, some other crimes. You know, across the city, we have five different district attorneys who all have taken different stances during different times, but certainly now more than ever have kind of all aligned with the fact that they're not looking to prosecute folks for these COVID related offenses during this time period. There, some of them are just strictly declining to prosecute some of these people. Some of them are deferring the cases for months ago. And as we know, when you defer a person who we've locked up, you know, just this morning, we arrested an individual who was already locked up in the past 3 weeks, about 12 times for commercial burglaries. I mean, talk about preying on the defenseless. Businesses and restaurants and shop owners have closed their businesses in alliance with the governor's orders and the mayor's executive orders. But now we have a criminal out in the street who's taking advantage of that individual and his or her family and victimizing them. And then we arrest them and they're back out in the street. So you couple those variables with the release, and certainly, you know, someone who's older or who potentially was going to be released within the matter of a couple of weeks, we can talk about the possible release. But how do we release an individual who's out on parole for rape and he's in on a technical violation? And of course, tragically, what happened, he came out and raped another woman. So those two factors. And I'll say the drug component piece, as we know, traditional criminals and terrorists, they seek the opportunity when crises hits. We're fortunate, again, that we've kept our task forces, our joint task forces with the DEA, state police, FBI, and other state and federal agencies running. I mean, just 2 days ago, we had a seizure, $1 million hit off of one of our highways of heroin, coincidentally marked coronavirus. A couple of weeks ago, we had a nice hit of about 7 to 10 kilos of heroin and fentanyl hybrid. So the criminals out there certainly looking to capitalize on it. But so are our cops out there working with our task forces, working hard at hand. So the landscape obviously is going to change tremendously from the people that we allow into our facilities to what our police officers are actually wearing to, you know, thermal readings as they come in to ensure their well-being and their safety. But we're really concerned about the crime spike in the next couple of weeks. I mean, burglaries and, I said, theft of autos has been through the roof during this 56-day period, during this 8 weeks where we've been, quote-unquote, on lockdown in the city. As a result of people staying home, obviously, and their cars being parked, and of course, all the commercial businesses closing down. So with that, I'll kick it over to the next speaker.
Thank you very much, Chief Colonel Noble. Over to you, please.
Thank you. Just first, just like the chief, very similar over here in New Jersey. Overall, shootings are down. However, murders are actually up, but number of shootings in New Jersey are down. Robberies are down 50%. We know that that's a short-term trend. We also know that the opportunistic criminals understand and recognize that the change in law enforcement posture, whether that's more tolerance that they may be seeing out on the highways with more speeders, whether that's the perceived reduction in our available workforce. We are very much focused on maintaining everything we can do to keep our eyes on the most dangerous criminals that are out there. We, just like the chief said from New York, we are actively engaged with all of our task forces. All of our intel apparatus is at full strength. We are monitoring and we are physically responding to any physical threats, any organized criminal element that's out there dealing, whether it's drugs and fentanyl. Our investigative apparatus certainly are at full strength, and we don't plan on changing that. But the reality is that there's a perception out there that law enforcement's otherwise busy doing other things related to COVID. So that is a bit of a messaging piece. It is important just so we can prevent crime, and we can prevent those that might be on the fence thinking about getting into crime, and knowing that we still stand on that line. And so messaging that is something that's part of our strategy over the next several weeks to months. Regarding changes of the way we operate to operate in a COVID environment, we are looking at some tactical changes and looking at some things by the manners in which whether it's conduct a traffic stop, whether it's conduct a roadside interview or an investigation. We absolutely are looking at revamping some of our training and our direction to our officers so that they can conduct their investigations or conduct their police work, yet doing so in a responsible manner to try to protect themselves, whether that's wearing masks, whether that's having anybody that we come in contact with wear masks. Those are all right now the focus of our training bureau and our tactical folks, and we do anticipate there'll be some changes to the manner in which we conduct our frontline operations regarding that. Sales of guns, yes, absolutely, are up. It's an issue. We are experiencing a bit of a backlog that we're trying to work through with the licensing side of it. But that being said, that offsets that is the fact that our shootings are down. As of right now, our shootings statewide are down about 20% from where they were last year. Back to you.
Thank you very kindly. And now, Secretary Doral, you'll have last word. And then unless John Allen wants to also say farewell and thank you, I will conclude things with a brief note of gratitude. But please, first, Secretary Doral, over to you.
Yes, thank you. And again, I can't emphasize how grateful both Dr. Eastman and I are that we are able to participate in this. This is an outstanding call. We do several of these each week, and certainly this is outstanding. So thank you for organizing, and thank everyone who got on the call. Hopefully we provided you some good advice. And I just want to also say at DHS, we are a resource. If you need anything that we can help, state and locals, please reach out to our office as well. I just want to finish up with the drug question. That's a great concern to us. We know that high percentage of the nation's drugs flow over the Southwest border. The Southwest border, the points of entry are all closed at this time. We know that it may be slowing the amount of drugs coming into the country, but it's certainly not stopping. We're seeing other techniques used, such as the use of drones to get them over the border and other innovative ways. So I think at this time, one could say that it's slowing it down, but it's certainly not stopping the flow of drugs into the country at this time.
Thank you very much. John, would you like to say anything to conclude before I also say farewell?
I would, Mike. I just want to thank everyone who was part of this today. General Robinson has dropped, but we'll thank her separately. But for Paul and Rick and thank you for your long careers of tremendous service to our people and to our country. And to Chief Pichardo and Lieutenant Colonel Noble, thank you very much for all that you're doing in New York City and in New Jersey. You are emblematic and representative of the law enforcement leadership and law enforcement officials across this entire country. The sacrifices you make on our behalf every single day are deeply, deeply appreciated by all of us. And I want to thank all of you for having participated in this afternoon. Over to you, Mike.
All I can say is amen. Well said, John. Thank you, everyone. Really an honor for us. And we certainly intend to keep at this at Brookings so others can please, you know, the broader public and audience, please continue to weigh in with your suggestions, questions, and thoughts. But again, from Brookings, signing off with gratitude to everybody.